Treblinka Commandant Dr. Ebels Befford's aroused amazement and then harsh criticism from his SS superiors. He was so ambitious that he took to ordering more transports than the camp could cope with in a vain attempt to impress his superiors. Quote, that meant that trains had to wait outside the camp because the occupants of the previous transport had not yet all been killed, said SS-Unterscharführer Mentz. At the time, it was very hot, and as a result of the long wait inside the transport trains in the intense heat, many people died. At that time, whole mountains of bodies lay on the platform. Then Hauptsturmführer Christian Wirth came to Treblinka and kicked up a terrific row, and one day, Dr. Ebel was no longer there, unquote. Ermfried Ebel was dismissed on the 26th of August 1942 for incompetence in the disposal of bodies and replaced by Franz Stangl. It was interesting that Wirth and Ebel had already worked together during the T4 euthanasia program that had preceded the horrors of Aktion Reinhard. Wirth, born in 1895, came from humble origins, the son of a cooper. After serving in the army from 1905 to 1910, he had joined the police in Stuttgart, being made a detective. When the First World War broke out, Wirth immediately volunteered and served on the Western Front, winning the Iron Cross First and Second Class for bravery. In 1919, he returned to policing as a detective sergeant, next joining the Nazi Party and the SA. In 1937, Wirth joined the SD and was soon commissioned into the SS. As a captain in the Kripo, or criminal police, Wirth was detached from Stuttgart to join the T4 program, serving in an administrative role. In Prussia, he served alongside Dr. Ebel at Brandenburg an der Fulda, before becoming personnel director at the Hartheim Institute. Wirth's value was recognized by his appointment as commandant of Chełmno extermination camp, where he oversaw gassing operations using special vans. On the 1st of August 1942, Odilo Globocznik appointed Wirth inspector of the Reinhard death camps, with special responsibility over Sobibor and Treblinka II. Wirth's choice for the new commandant of Treblinka II to replace Dr. Ebel was another valued T4 man. 34-year-old Franz Stangl, an Austrian like his predecessor, had been an apprentice weaver in the 1920s, before moving to Innsbruck and joining the police in 1930. And like Ebel, Stangl joined the Nazi Party in 1931, which was an illegal act for a policeman at the time. After the German takeover of Austria in 1938, Stangl was assigned to the Gestapo-administered Schutzpolizei, working for the Jewish Bureau in Linz. The same year, Stangl joined the SS. From this, Stangl gravitated to the T4 program as security director at the Hartheim Institute near Linz, serving under Christian Wirth. In March 1942, Stangl was offered a choice. Either return to the police in Linz, where he had been having problems with his boss, or transfer to Lublin in Poland as part of Globocznik's Aktion Reinhard. The then SS Obersturmführer Stangl naturally chose the latter and was appointed the first commandant of Sobibor extermination camp, overseeing the final construction phase before command was transferred to Hauptsturmführer Franz Reichsleitner. In August 1942, Stangl was ordered by Globocznik to Treblinka II to replace Ebel. He brought with him an outstanding reputation as an administrator and manager of staff, with a good eye for detail. He inherited a complete mess from Ebel, a camp that was literally knee-deep in unburied corpses and a demoralized and often drunken staff. But Stangl rose to the challenge set by his SS masters and quickly got things cleaned up and running efficiently. He was promoted to Hauptsturmführer and soon got used to the death that surrounded him on a daily basis. Quote, they were cargo, Stangl said of the Jews. His desensitization began on the day of his arrival. Quote, I remember Wirth standing there next to the pits full of blue-black corpses. It was a mass of rotting flesh. Wirth said, what shall we do with all this garbage? I think, unconsciously, that started me thinking of them as cargo. I rarely saw them as individuals. It was always a huge mass. I sometimes stood on the wall and saw them in the tube, the road of heaven. They were naked, packed together, running, being driven with whips, unquote. The prisoners called Stangl the White Death because he often wore a white summer tunic with his grey SS cap and trousers. Stangl generally stayed away from the prisoners, making him an austere and remote figure within the world of the camp. The man who managed to transform Jewish resistance into a cohesive and organized force at Treblinka too was a medical doctor and former captain in the Polish army. Dr. Julian Korozajki had been hauled off one of the transports in 1942 and forced to work in the SS Medical Center, providing his tormentors with first-class medical care. As fellow plotter Samuel Reitzmann would say of Korozajki, he was, quote, a noble man, essential to taking action, unquote. Korozajki gathered together men and women from the different Sonderkommandos and formulated a plan of escape. The organizing committee comprised Korozajki, Zev Kurland, the capo or prisoner supervisor in the lazaret or medical center, Lieutenant Zelo Bloch, a Czech army officer who had recently been transferred to Treblinka from Theresienstadt, leader of the tailors group Salzburg, and an agronomist named Sadowitz. Korozajki believed that the easiest way to obtain arms would be through bribing certain Ukrainian SS guards with gold and money that the Goldjuden managed to hide through their job of gathering valuables from incoming transports. One of the conspirators, Kapo Moshi of the carpentry shop, gave a Ukrainian guard a large bribe in return for a pistol, but the Ukrainian never produced the weapon. Whilst further efforts were being made to bribe guards, the escape organization decided that stealing weapons from the camp armory might have to be attempted. Fortunately, at the very time that the prisoners were getting interested in the camp armory, the SS ordered a Jewish locksmith to repair the lock on the door. Whilst doing this, the locksmith secretly made a duplicate key for the lock. In March 1943, Lieutenant Bloch, the leader who was providing military expertise in the planning of the revolt, was suddenly transferred to Camp 3, where the killing apparatus was located. In a desperate effort to get some arms, Dr. Korozajki procured a large stack of banknotes taken from arriving transports with a view to bribing an SS Travniki guard whose trust he believed he had gained. But this plot to escape was discovered by Untersturmführer Franz. When the deputy commandant arrived to arrest Korozajki, the doctor attacked him with a surgical knife and, from the resultant struggle, managed to swallow poison to avoid being tortured and giving away his fellow accomplices' names. In the light of the currency that was discovered in Chorozaiki's possession, Treblinka was carefully searched. The Goldjuden was severely beaten and questioned, but without result for the SS. Camp Elder Rakowski was brought in to head the committee with Chorozaiki's demise, and more Jews joined the organization, including Rudek Lubenicki, who was in charge of the camp garage. The first attempt was made to smuggle arms and ammunition out of the camp armory, part of a fresh revolt plan codenamed the Hour. The Sonderkommando were to simultaneously rise up and attack the SS and Travniki guards with whatever weapons they could find, steal their weapons and then launch an attack on the Kommandantur. The aim was to seize control of the camp and hopefully kill the new commandant, Hauptsturmführer Stangl. But though the young boys who worked in the SS quarters adjacent to the armory hut managed to steal two boxes of stick grenades, on examination it was found that the detonators were missing. The Germans kept the grenade detonators in a separate box, ready to prime the weapons if they needed them. Typhus struck the camp, killing many of those who planned to rise and leaving many others too sick and weak to do anything but attempt to cling on to life. The putative revolt was postponed indefinitely. In early May, Deputy Commandant Franz had Camp Elder Rakowski shot after he was discovered to be in possession of gold and currency. The Treblinka underground once again was without a leader. But at the same time that Rakowski was executed, another ex-Polish army officer, Dr. Berek Leischer, arrived at the camp. A Jew from Czestochowa, Leischer felt that he had nothing to lose, since his wife and 13-year-old son had been killed during the liquidation of the Wegerow ghetto. The SS put him in charge of their clinic. Soon he was secretly asked to head the Treblinka underground. Kapo Moishi, leader of the skilled workers, also joined in the fresh conspiracy. A new plan was formulated after a series of secret meetings in the tailor's hut, with the date for the rising set for the 15th of June 1943, but this was subsequently postponed until Monday, 2nd of August. In the interim period, the killing of Jews from the transports had reached a fever pitch, but then started to slow down towards the end of July. It was clear that the Sonderkommandos would soon have outlived their usefulness to the Germans and would be liquidated by the SS. This prompted the underground to select a new date in early August, before it was too late. There were about 60 Jews in Camp 1 that were part of the conspiracy. Based upon their work huts, each group was divided into subunits of 5 to 10 people under a commander. The smaller organization in Camp 3 was growing particularly nervous. The disposal of corpses was coming to an end, and they knew that once this grisly job was finished, they would be the first ones to be liquidated by the SS. Acting as a courier between the two groups was master carpenter Jankel Viernik, whose job enabled him to move between the two parts of the camp without arousing suspicion. The date of the 2nd of August was eventually settled upon when the group in Camp 3 threatened to launch their own rising without reference to Camp 1 if no date could be agreed upon. They were armed only with the tools of their jobs, shovels, pitchforks and axes. The final plan was in two parts. Stage A would involve removing arms from the German armory and transferring them to the combat groups in Camp 1. The combat groups were then quietly deployed to their targets, the camp headquarters, the SS and Ukrainian barracks, and the camp's watchtowers. The final part of Stage A would involve the quiet elimination of as many of the SS NCOs as possible. This part of the plan would be strikingly similar to that successfully carried out at another Reinhard camp, Sobibor. The SS NCOs would be lured singly into various workshops on certain pretexts, and there murdered by the Sonderkommandos. Removing the SS NCOs was deemed of prime importance because they were the brains behind the whole operation, controlled the camp, ordered executions, and commanded the Ukrainian auxiliaries. Removing them should lead to confusion inside the camp and a less than organized response by the remaining SS. Once enough SS had been killed, it was planned that a general uprising would commence and the Jews would attempt to break out of the camp and escape into the surrounding forest. A Monday was sensibly chosen because it was rest day at Treblinka II, and Dr. Leischer and his conspirators knew that some of the guards would probably leave the camp for rest and relaxation. In fact, several SSTV, plus about 40 Travnikis, left in trucks for the Bug River for swimming. With a much-reduced guard component and no transport trains due, Leischer judged this to be the most opportune moment to strike. The day dawned sizzling hot and remained so all day. For the prisoners who were involved in the revolt, the previous night had passed very slowly with hardly any sleep. Carpenter Jankel Viernik had lain in his bunk thinking about the massive difficulties that the escapers would have to overcome if they were ever to reach freedom, particularly the wooden guard towers that were mounted with machine guns. But Viernik, like many of the other Jews involved in the revolt, wanted to bear witness to what the Germans had done. Quote, "I, for one, was determined to live to present to the world a description of the inferno and a sketch of the layout of the accursed hellhole," he recounted. "This resolve had given me the strength to struggle against the hangmen and the endurance to bear the misery. Somehow I felt that I would survive our break for freedom." Unquote.